You're listening to a download from the outdoorstation.co.uk. Number 520.
Hello and welcome once again back to the Outdoors Station, the longest running outdoors podcast in the world. If you're a lover of the great outdoors and the world around us, and you're always seeking to know more, then this interview that you're about to hear will give you plenty to think about while we all sit at home and twiddle our thumbs during this COVID-19 isolation. I'm your host, Bob Cartwright, and in January, before all of this started, I had the pleasure to speak with Emily Penn, an ocean advocate, about the plastics in the oceans, the plastics in our outdoor environment we all share, and horrifically, the microplastics within us. But before we get into that conversation, I wanted to fill you in with what's been going on here. It's been a jam-packed week for me. Last Friday, as promised, I did a private live stream with all the Outdoor Station newsletter members, discussing ideas for future live streams starting, hopefully, next week. We kicked around topics that people stuck at home might like to see and how regular these streams could be. The upshot is that starting next week, the 6th of April 2020, I'll be attempting to produce 3 live stream programs a week at 7 p.m. UK time, Monday, Wednesday, and either Thursday or Friday, plus continuing to release the audio podcasts as well. As these streams will be on YouTube and Facebook, I've started the Outdoor Station Live Facebook page for people to join, so please have a hunt for that and share it with your friends. So I'm going to post my schedule there and on all the various social media. I've already got guests lined up for the next 3 weeks. There's topics such as cooking and camping tips, dehydrators, an introduction to tarps, various gear reviews, plus I have a few giveaways already lined up to give away during the show. Talking of gear reviews, when I post my forthcoming schedule and mention perhaps a particular product, I'm going to invite you, the viewers, to send in a 30-second video review from your phone to add a different perspective to some of the shows. Everybody's going to get involved. As you can imagine, this is going to add up to a vast amount of time to invest in the project. If one podcast a week is already taking me 2+ days, you can imagine the research and preparation work for this is going to fill the rest of the week. But I'm going to give it a shot and see how we get on. So if you haven't done so already, please visit theoutdoorstation.co.uk to get all the links to Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, Twitter, and join the newsletter should you wish to do so. Make sure you sign up to one or more because I'll be posting the schedule and also the up-to-date notes before the show goes live. So join me on the show, join in with the live chat, and see where it takes us. Emily Penn is an ocean advocate. Her name may be familiar, and you might have seen her on mainstream TV, giving TED Talks, speaking at universities, or global companies sharing some of her adventures and her research. But more importantly, she is an international advisor on issues related to our oceans and future society. I've titled this podcast Making the Unseen Seen after speaking with Emily, because as you'll hear, she was fortunate, or unfortunate, I should say, to have a body burden test some years ago and was horrified to hear what percentage of plastics were in her system and, naturally, probably in ours too. The upshot is that her story is one of a series of events which have linked together to place her to be one of only a handful of people who truly know the impacts that single-use plastics are making in our lives globally. And it all started when she finished university and wanted to hitchhike to a new job in Australia.
So So I was looking for a way to get to this new job as an architect in Australia, but rather than taking an aeroplane, I wanted to hitchhike on a boat around the world. And so ended up on this amazing project called Earth Race, a boat that had broken the round the world speed record. It ran on biodiesel and was on its way from England to Australia. So I managed to get on board as part of the crew. And it was on that journey where we crossed the Pacific and I started to see plastic. Every morning when I went for a swim off the side of the boat, we didn't have any running water on board, so we had to swim for a wash each day. And then the islands that we landed on, whether they were uninhabited atolls that we found covered in plastic, or these inhabited little Pacific Island communities like Tonga, when we started to find the plastic as well.
Well, Earth Race, from the little bit of Googling I've done, looks like a really space age design machine that you can see why it beat the speed record. Just simply looking at the boat itself, just touching on that, because I know you've got a history of sailing and youth sailing. Was it luxurious inside as it looked outside, or was it extremely basic?
Yeah, not at all, unfortunately. Looks very sleek and glamorous from the exterior, but the inside, so the widest point I could touch with both my fingers at the same time with my arms spread out. So it was this tiny little capsule that had four bunks, two seats, and a sort of electric wok, which we did all our cooking on. No running water, no toilet, no shower. And it was just kind of bare carbon fiber and hemp on the inside. So definitely not luxurious, but was an amazing way to kind of see the world and come into all of these different communities and right from the off be able to talk to them about the environment and challenges going on in their communities.
As I said before, I know you had a youth history of sailing and racing and in dinghies and so on. Was this the first time you'd been to the open ocean, as it were, and experienced the landscape and what it contained?
It was. So I grew up sailing, one person sailing dinghies, but it wasn't until I was 21 that I first got on board a big boat, something that I spent, a night on, was basically when I set off across the Atlantic. So that side of things was really new for me, and that project really gave me that opportunity to experience blue water sailing and navigation and all of those things that you need to know when you cross an ocean. But it was great that I did have some background in sailing. And I think certainly then when I moved into yachts, having that experience of just knowing the wind and knowing how to feel a boat respond was something that was so, so useful then in becoming a skipper.
And how many years ago was this now?
So 12 years ago, I got on board Earth Race.
12 years ago. Okay. So 12 years ago, then what was your impression, as you say, when you were diving off the boat each day for a wash or whatever, the actual density of the plastics that you were being presented with? Was it, I can't say really like a copious amount, but was there more at arm's reach whenever you were out in the water?
Yeah, so there were certain areas. I remember coming through the Panama Canal and then we crossed from Panama to Galapagos. And actually, for a few days, we were following one of these windrows. So you have a change in the current and it aggregates lots of debris along a line. And we went along it for days and we could see plastic bags, wellies, bits of plastic, buckets, containers. And we saw a TV floating out there at one point. And that's for me when it just started to click. What on earth is all of this plastic doing out here? And it's just entirely not what I expected I was heading to when I set off into the Pacific. So we were sort of welcomed into the Pacific with that. And then when we got to these gyre areas where the water was very calm, that's where we jumped off the boat and we started to see these fragments on the surface as well. And then it was the uninhabited islands that struck me next, because we would land on these atolls where there wasn't a single sign of life. And then you'd find a toothbrush, a bottle top, a cigarette lighter, littering the beach. And it just went on and on.
Yeah, that's going to make quite an impression on you, isn't it? Just explain to listeners what a gyre is. I know there's seven gyres in the across the world, but I'm sure you can explain it much better than I can.
Yeah, so a gyre is really the name we give to the centre of a fast rotation of currents. So as our planet spins, it creates this Coriolis effect, which is a huge rotation in currents in our ocean. And in the centre is this calm patch. And as meteorologists, or if you're watching the weather, they would call it the centre of the high. And it's the same phenomenon that's kind of causing a gyre. And there's five subtropical gyres around the world that we look at. And then there's a few smaller ones in the Arctic and more localised as well.
I know you were going down to Australia, but it was the impression that Tonga, I believe, or one of the islands there in the South Pacific that really hit you the hardest.
It was. So crossing through those little islands, you know, we'd been to the uninhabited atolls, but then we started coming into these local remote communities. And I think what hit me there actually was the struggle they had with their own natural resources. So communities that would have traditionally been catching fish and growing food were no longer able to do that. Their fisheries had been fished out, and their soil was now so salty from their rising sea levels that they couldn't grow crops either. But what I was then seeing was the knock-on effect of that, which was relying on importing packaged food and drink. And that's where all this plastic came in to these communities that don't have any waste management system or even a word in their language for talking about rubbish or a bin or this idea of putting something in a controlled system. And I think that for me is where I started to realize that actually it's not just infrastructure that these communities need, but actually completely new systems and new ways of thinking about this new problem on their doorstep.
And I suppose really... I think plastic bags were technically, or somebody said they were invented in 1959. So we're only looking at 50 odd years, but at this particular time you came across this particular island. I know you went to Australia and decided not to pursue your career as an architect, but head back to Tonga. So what format did that take? How did you arrive there? Did you arrive there officially as a guest, as part of the local government, or did you just go as a sort of a traveller trying to see what you could find out, see what you could do?
Yeah, more of the latter, really. I finished the project on Earth Race in New Zealand, and by that time had met some others who were interested in doing the same thing as well. In fact, one of them had just sailed back through Tonga from the Galapagos and seen the same thing I had. And so we put together a small team of people in New Zealand, literally kind of borrowed a boat from someone's dad who came with us. And off we went. You know, we sailed up to Tonga. It took us 10 days. And we arrived initially thinking that we would do a big cleanup event of what we'd seen. But actually, on arrival, we realized that the problem was kind of much bigger than it had seemed from the surface. And we started then to meet with local government, with the local bank, with the local phone company, you know, looking for support, whether it was through permissions and also some financially, to really see how much traction there was. And it turned out there was actually a lot of desire to make a big project happen. And that kind of gave us the energy then to head up into these very remote islands and start the conversation with the locals there. And which was very well received. And so the project kind of turned into something a bit bigger when we arrived. And then I was the one who ended up staying there for 6 months, working with the community on making it happen.
So they, as a community then, they were aware of the problem that was being presented to them on their beaches. Had they not motivated themselves or tried to create their own sort of clearing system?
So certainly the government, who we met in the capital, were very aware of it. And that's where we really felt the support. When we got actually out to the outer islands where the problem existed, they were for sure aware of the issue, but there was still very little understanding. On the first few days there, I actually grabbed a bunch of kids just to do a quick cleanup of a short bit of shoreline. And you know, asked them to go and kind of grab everything. And we all went off in different directions and came back. And the kids had picked up all of the plastic, but they'd also picked up the coconut husks and the palm fronds. And there was actually very little understanding of the difference between organic and inorganic materials, and the fact that one biodegrades and the other one doesn't. And so that was kind of the realization of there needed to be, you know, a good amount of education about this completely new material, plastic, and why it needed to be treated in a different way.
And so your 6 month period came to an end there. How did it conclude on the island? Had you instigated some sort of recycling process? Had they had external investment into the island at all?
Yeah, so we culminated in the fifth month of the 6 month project with an enormous cleanup to get everybody involved. So we actually had 3,000 people, which was three quarters of the whole population, come and pick up plastic. We actually managed to pick up 56 tons in just 5 hours, so a staggering amount. But it was also an opportunity to get everybody out, actually taking that action. Of doing something, learning how to sort it, and then where it goes. So we'd set up a shed on the dock. It was actually an old copra shed, and turned that into a recycling store. And so through the process of that cleanup, everyone in this community had a chance to go out and then bring it to this place where they then sorted it, and so understood how the system was going to then work going forward. And so that was a system set up with the local government and also the local shipping company to be able to then take it away.
And I presume you've kept in touch in the last 14, 15 years. What's been the legacy of your action?
Yeah, so actually the following few years were really successful. And then in 2015, they had a cyclone hit right on that island. In fact, the eye of the cyclone went over the house that I was living in while I was there, and it destroyed 75% of all of the homes and trees on that island. And it's been a bit of a struggle ever since, because then they go back into survival mode. There's a lot of aid brought in with a lot of single-use plastic for all food, water, and housing. And it has been hard to kind of re-establish since. We've actually got our team this year going back through Tonga, and so it's going to be a great opportunity to really see what the situation is now.
And what was the solution to the range of plastics and rope and whatever else that you picked up off the beach? What is the solution in a place where I presume there's nowhere to ship waste to?
No, exactly. And that was, I think, the thing about this project is it was still dealing with the symptom. And, you know, what X Expedition is trying to do now and projects I've been working on since is trying to say exactly that. Well, what is actually the solution here? Because a waste management system isn't a solution. It's just something that you can implement, you know, afterwards. And so the ultimate answer for these islands is to have less reliance on plastic. So whether that means switching to alternative materials or simply minimizing the amount of plastic that they use, and looking at setting up more localized ways that you can actually package products, because one of the challenges at the moment is they are importing everything in its final state of use. So, for example, noodles are imported in single serve packets, rather than importing large sacks of, say, flour and then setting up a bakery on the island to make bread. And then you can actually really minimize packaging. And so a lot of the solutions lie in actually setting up new systems and restructuring, you know, how things are done in these places, so that they can actually import produce, but do it in a way that they don't also import all the plastic.
And just looking at Tonga as an example under the microscope, would it be fair to say it's a bit of a generational thing, that the older generation that would have been the bakers and that would have been the practical people, the weavers, etc., and they have retired, died, left the island, whatever they might have done, and the younger generation coming through have just got used to the convenience of everything being at the end of a phone call?
I wouldn't say that was so true in the Pacific Islands, to be honest. I mean, definitely, I think you could look at that over here in the UK. But in the Pacific Islands, up until recently, they'd actually been able to rely off, you know, the land and the sea. And I think the biggest change is that that's simply no longer possible because of such depleted resources. And so I don't think they even would have had bakers because they wouldn't have been importing flour. They would have been growing taro in the ground, and that they can no longer do. So I think that's been probably the biggest change. I think we will see the other shifts that you're mentioning, partly because these islands are becoming more connected. When I was out there, there was barely any connection with the Western world. Some of the islands in Kiribati that I've been working on since have no connection at all. And so you don't have that same value set that we have over here. And those are the problems. But there's other things that prevent it happening. And one I particularly saw in Kiribati was actually quite a beautiful phenomenon called the bobos, which is this idea that a sort of shared economy, that if I walk up to you and you've got a T-shirt on and you're hanging up a T-shirt on your washing line and I don't have a T-shirt on, I clearly have a higher need for that T-shirt than you do. And so I can babose you the T-shirt and you give it to me because I need it more, knowing that when you need something, you will kind of get it back. And this lovely idea of a sharing economy works until you try and set up a business like a bakery and have a boat that's only coming in once every 6 months with supplies. And one of the challenges I found here in Kiribati on looking at how you could set up these local sustainable economies is that actually when there's then a need, someone's hungry, you know, they come along to the shop that sells things. But if they don't have any money, then there's kind of this local philosophy that you give when you have to others who are in need. And it makes the idea of setting up a kind of a shop really tricky. So that there's other big challenges that I found make it really hard to transition a Pacific Island community that's used to living day by day and subsistence living into something more like we're used to in the West.
Wow, and there's a big political problem, isn't there? I'm sure you felt like you were introducing something which is against their culture, and the whole point of being there was to appreciate their natural culture and the way they've always done things. So what a difficult balance to do, blimey.
Exactly. And I think it just made me realise, you know, how vulnerable these islands are. I mean, certainly that cyclone that hit Tonga made me really think about that. And then also how connected we are. You know, we all share an atmosphere and we all share an ocean, and our actions on one side of the world really do affect communities on the other, in a place that we don't even know these communities exist and we're so cut off from them. And it affects them in a way that they don't really have the tools to overcome, even when we try and put our kind of Western mindset to solving these problems. It just doesn't work. And so, yeah, really big challenges in these little islands.
I just want to reassure listeners that this conversation is obviously going along the lines of the plastics and the problem with pollution in the oceans. But it's more immediate than that to listeners anywhere in the world that are currently listening to this. And the one thing that really inspired me to talk to you and work backwards, if you like, from that was related to the blood test that you had, that you chose to do in, I think, 2014, and yeah, the reasons for doing it and what came out of that as a result. Because I think that's the important thing for listeners to hear, because as we touch on a bit of your history, we can learn more about how you were brought up, your diet, and what you'd had in the past, and yet you've had a result which surprised you no end.
It did, absolutely. So that blood test, we tested for 35 chemicals that are banned because they're toxic to humans. So they're banned by the United Nations. And of those 35 chemicals, I discovered I had 29 of them in my blood. And I really wasn't expecting. I thought maybe we'd find one or two. But we literally found everything from pesticides to brominated compounds, which are things used as flame retardants in our upholstery and our electronics and our clothes. And then fluorinated compounds, which are maybe not so surprising for me, but we use them on things like our waterproof clothing, which obviously I've worn a lot of over the years, being out on the water so much. But we also use them in our non-stick frying pans and anywhere that we want to kind of repel water. I really wasn't expecting to find so many of them in my body, and then to go on to learn that actually there's not really any way you can get rid of them either, other than this connection with our children, where it looks like we most likely pass them on to them when we have children.
And just give people an idea of your healthy lifestyle at the time you did this, what you were eating, you know, just a bit of background so people can understand a bit more where you were situated, as it were, before you did this blood test.
Yeah, so probably kind of from two extremes. You know, I grew up eating food from an allotment in the back garden, pretty much as healthy as you can get. And so, again, wouldn't have thought that I'd have any pesticides from that. But then to the extreme of living on a small island in the South Pacific in Tonga for 6 months, where I was dealing every day with these burn piles of waste. And there was one thing in particular going on which alarmed me at the time, where there were computers being imported from Australia and New Zealand. It was part of some tax break at the time to kind of gift your computers as aid. And so they were arriving in these Pacific islands, but of course they were old, dated computers that didn't really bring much to these islanders, and a lot of them quickly corroded in the salty, humid air. And so they were just getting tossed on these burn piles, which was the only way they really got rid of any waste on these islands. And a lot of the chemicals that you use in those electronics, there's one in particular called BDE-47, a brominated compounds that's a flame retardant. And when I had my blood tested, I had a crazy high level of that BDE-47 inside my blood, way more than anyone else that got tested.
Where were you tested? Were you tested in the UK or somewhere else?
Yes, it was actually a lab in Stockholm.
Okay. Is there a name for this test? Is there a test that anybody can do, or was it something specifically set up for you for scientific reasons?
It was a project that was going on by the United Nations at the time, and it was called a body burden. So that idea of looking at your chemical footprint, and a whole group of people did it, including some politicians. It's not running anymore, and it's actually very hard to just go to your doctor and try and find out by yourself. But it was a study where lots of people from different parts of the world were tested.
You're listening to the award-winning outdoorstation.co.uk, sharing knowledge and experience of others in the outdoors world.
Yes, but a real eye-opening moment, I'm sure.
Absolutely. And triggered X Expedition and everything I've done since.
Well, that naturally leads us on to it, doesn't it? So let's move on nicely. X Expedition, yes, they're so good they X'd it twice. Why is it called X Expedition?
So that is a reference to women, to that female chromosome. And the reason of setting up an all-women expedition was because really of that blood test, finding out that actually these chemicals inside us, they are hormone disruptors or endocrine disruptors. So they mimic our hormones and stop those important chemical messages moving around our bodies. And actually for women, having those chemicals inside us during pregnancy is really bad news. And as I mentioned, we can then pass them on to our children when we give birth. So it struck me that actually this toxic story was quite a female-centered issue. And having already met so many amazing trailblazing women by this point working on plastics, I thought, why not set sail across the Atlantic Ocean with a team of women? So that's how it began, as a one-off sailing voyage. And here we are now, 5 years later, taking a boat around the world.
Okay, so as I looked on the website related to it just before speaking to you, I see that I think it said it set off on its latest voyage in October 2019. And that was a two-year planned voyage, and you're rotating the crew, about 300 women, is that right?
That is right, yes. So it's 30 voyage legs over those 2 years, sailing 38,000 nautical miles around the world. So it's sort of around the world and then a bit more because we go up through the Arctic before returning back to the UK. And every leg has 10 different women from different nationalities and different skills because we realize that to solve these issues of plastic pollution, toxic pollution, really all these global challenges, there's not one answer, but there's hundreds, and they need people from all different backgrounds to come together to work on solving it from different sectors.
I can see what you're doing here. It's a cunning plan. I do appreciate the cunning plan. So basically what you're doing is building up an army of influencers and ambassadors to experience this firsthand so they understand the importance and passion that goes into it, and also the passion that should be going into educating the younger generation and the current generation, really. Well, not so much the younger generation, it's my generation, our generation, that's actually created the problem. So it's a great idea. Since the launch date in October then, has the first crew moved on and you've recrewed?
Yes, absolutely. So we've got our seventh crew on board right now. So 60 women have already been on board and are now back home. And that's taken us from Plymouth across the North Atlantic, through the Caribbean, through the Panama Canal to Galapagos. And right now the boat is on its way to Easter Island, where I will join them next week.
And I should imagine the administration for not only getting the people on board, but following up and seeing how they're progressing as regards sharing their story must be quite complicated. But are you sort of keeping tabs on it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you can imagine the administration for this whole project is just enormous, trying to get an ocean-going research vessel around the world, doing scientific research, global media, and everyone sort of safely back home. It is quite a mission in itself. But as you say, you know, really, much of the work begins when everyone gets home, because I always feel like that moment when you step off the boat from an expedition is actually the moment that feels like day one. And you take all of those findings back to land and you start really addressing the problem. So we've got a lot of work to do on that front now in terms of how we support our ambassadors further and really connect them to opportunities that are kind of out there. And we've just recently announced an exciting partnership with SAP, the tech company, who we're working with at the moment to build a platform to do exactly what you're asking, to be able to allow that community of people to have a home online, to connect, to collaborate, and to really take their work forward further.
I was looking at some of your video clips on your website and had a very entertaining half hour watching the Sky documentary, where somebody circumnavigated the UK, or your team circumnavigated the UK, and you joined them for a bit. And I was fascinated to see the actual work that they were doing in picking up the microplastics and how they broke down, but also how they were affecting the marine life, etc. If people look at that video, is it similar to the experience that your seven crews have found so far?
Yes, although I would also say, you know, they found a lot more plastic in certain areas. So that circumnavigation of the UK was fascinating because we had lots of ports that we could come into. There was a lot of outreach. We found particularly in the mouth of the Thames, there was a lot of plastic. But the UK isn't in a gyre. It's not in one of these accumulation zones. So the second leg of our voyage sailed from Azores to Antigua, and that was going straight through the heart of the North Atlantic gyre. And so the quantity of plastic that was being found there is far beyond anything that we found around the UK. And then likewise through some of the Caribbean islands and on arrival into Panama, where it's slightly different. You're not in a gyre, but you're in places where the waste management systems just don't exist, or at least they're nothing like they are in the UK. And so the huge amounts of plastic pollution that were found there as well. So similar work, but really different results.
It sounds like you're also being faced, when you travel through the different areas, with the local politics and the local attitude as regards if they see a problem, their attitude towards the problem, whether they value it as a problem and see that it's affecting their economy, their tourism, their water supply. There must be a lot of, from a political point of view, a lot of balls to juggle in the air at any one time.
Absolutely. There's so many different priorities, and especially with a lot of, you know, when you're talking at a government level. I was working in Indonesia a few years ago, trying to get engagement on the plastics issue. And at the same time, there were huge forest fires and people were dying daily because of that. And it's quite hard to kind of focus on something that you're saying could have an impact in the future when you've got imminent challenges happening right now. And so, as you say, you know, lots of balls to juggle, you know, certainly at a government level in how we deal with this. And but there is great opportunity right now, certainly for industry and the private sector to really lead the way on a lot of the solutions that we want to see. And there's a lot of change that we can bring in, you know, using our own individual behaviour and action as well.
Well, I certainly want to come on that onto that subject towards the end, if I may. And I was, as you say, we're not in Ajar, but I was up in the northwest of Scotland a couple of years ago on Skye, and I couldn't believe the amount of plastics that were being brought in on an hourly basis, really, onto the beaches up there. So we are being affected in this country, and this isn't just a conversation we're having about the rest of the world. This is happening wherever you are.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. We're all ending up with that plastic on our shores. We're also all contributing to it, whether we realize it or not. There's a lot of kind of invisible ways that we contribute to this issue, whether it's putting something in our recycling bin here at home and taking it, you know, out to your bin outside, thinking that it's going to go off and be recycled, and surprising how much of that actually ends up in other countries. And we lose track of where a lot of that waste goes, and whether it's going into the ocean or not, we're not particularly sure. But there's a high chance that some of it is. The other thing I think we often forget is every time we buy something from the rest of the world, whether it's from China, and we're importing something, we only import the final product. And when you look at the entire supply chain of making something, like a mobile phone, you don't actually see the amount of waste that's in the supply chain. So every time one part moves to a factory, another factory, lots of waste is discarded in that packaging. It's then sort of a number of parts are put together into a circuit board. They then get packaged up again. They get sent on to the next factory. That packaging then gets discarded. It gets put into another piece. It gets onto the next factory. And that process goes on and on. And actually, the amount of waste that's produced in making a product can be around 5 times the weight of the product itself that you then import. Not to mention the carbon emissions that we then leave behind in the rest of the world as well. And so this whole idea of kind of us and them is a really tricky one. And, you know, we really, our actions go so much further beyond what we see. And then beyond that, we all share that same ocean and atmosphere in the end. And as you say, you're sat there on Skye and you're seeing plastic washing in, which probably isn't coming from the UK, probably coming from somewhere else. And then our plastic from the UK is ending up on someone else's shores.
Mm. The audience that obviously we reach out to are predominantly hikers, outdoors people generally, and I'd like to think they've got a fairly good handle on the impact they're making when they're out in the wilds doing their hobby or activity. But having said that, we're all consumers, and of course, as the internet and social media has made it easier to sell something across the world, there are many people who are buying direct from China, and of course there's all sorts of hints of regards what environmental damage is taking place when you're buying a small single item from as far away as that, as you say, which goes through the whole manufacturing process there as well, and the outcome of some of the things that are being released into the oceans as well as the environment.
Exactly. No, and it's so unseen. Hence, X Expedition is on a mission to make the unseen seen. And we started that thinking about microplastics and toxics in our blood. And we realized that everywhere we look, there's another unseen that we need to make visible.
So with the X Expedition then being a 2-year project, at the end of the 2 years, do you have in mind a plan for how you're going to present this result to the world?
There'll be a combination of outcomes. There's, of course, the ongoing media storytelling, and we also will have a documentary that will come out at the end of those 2 years. So that will be one way of getting that story out. There's then, of course, the scientific work, which is in partnership with the University of Plymouth, and there'll be a number of papers that will be published during the 2 years, but at the end, the majority of that work will come out when we can have a global study. And what we really hope there is that our data will help show exactly what plastic is in the ocean, what polymer type, what fungi is growing on it, and where might it have come from, which industry, which continent, and therefore, where do our opportunities lie on land to create the change that we really need to see. So we hope that that's a huge piece of work which will go on to then influence government and industry. And then, of course, the work that these 300 women will do. And, you know, we hope that that will actually be something that will carry on throughout their lifetime. These journeys are certainly really transformative. The journey I did around the world 12 years ago, it totally transformed my life when I got out there to see this issue firsthand. And I hope that these journeys have a similar impact on the women who are coming and joining us. And there's really no end of opportunity of what they can do. And what they do, it will be very different depending on their circumstance, the country they live in, the job they have, their sphere of influence, you know, whether they work for Coca-Cola in the States or whether they live in a remote community in Indonesia. They have completely different opportunity for impact, both really powerful, but in very different ways.
Referring back to that documentary, one of the things that struck me again as being one of the most interesting and simple things which are affecting all of us was one of the scientists there were talking about the fibres that they were finding inside plankton.
Yes, absolutely. We're finding it now, yeah, even in the creatures that are the basis of our food chain. And we're finding just smaller and smaller particles. When I originally started doing this research 10 years ago, we were looking down to 333 microns, so a third of a millimeter. And we quickly realized that actually we weren't accounting for barely any of the plastic that we knew was going into the ocean. And that opened up all sorts of new scientific questions about what was sinking, what was getting eaten, but also what was so small that we just weren't measuring it. And so since then, we've been trying to measure to a smaller and smaller fragment size, which of course gets challenging with the equipment required to then actually detect what it is and that it is actually plastic and not something organic. When you get down to smaller than microplastics, what we call nanoplastics, if it's smaller than 1 micrometer. And so, as you say, we're realizing that at that scale, it's then very easy for it to get into marine life as well as larger pieces, which is scary.
The food chain itself is just starts with something very simple and works its way through, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
Okay, well, I mean, you're telling a very good story here that needs to be told, and you're obviously working really hard at getting that story out to people. I've seen numerous references on your website of the interviews you've done, the TV appearances, etc., etc. So, you know, the audience listening to this hopefully are aware and tuned in and agreeing with everything that you're saying. But of all the people that you are trying to speak to, who isn't listening? Who should be listening and who isn't listening?
I think at the moment, the government sector is probably the hardest to reach. And whether they're not listening is one thing, or whether they're just in a position where they're paralyzed to do anything yet is maybe possibly the reason as well. We're certainly hearing a lot from industry and from the private sector. I mean, I guess first we say that consumers are definitely listening. So we have individual action. I think then the next tier that we are hearing from our industry are saying, OK, we get it. We know there's a problem, but what do we do and what can we do? And whether they then actually have the opportunity to go to, you know, their shareholders and say, look, this is going to actually affect our bottom line. Are you willing to do it? I think that's yet to be seen. And then the final hard to reach group would be government. And we're going to need at some point government to step in and say, OK, industry have put their foot forward, they've invested, they've come up with solutions. Now we need to legislate to be able to level the playing field. And that is yet to be seen.
I see there's been a couple of countries that have actually completely banned single-use plastics.
They have, yeah. We've seen bans on microbeads first, so those small, tiny beads that go into our exfoliants and our cleaning products, which is a bit of a no-brainer, really, given that they're designed to go down the drain and end up in the sea. Then we've seen bans on plastic bags, which is a good step, but unsurprisingly has kind of brought up lots of loopholes. Quite a few countries have banned your standard supermarket bag, but then cornstarch bags are allowed, which are made from a biodegradable material. But actually, if a cornstarch bag ends up in the ocean, the microbes that like to eat it in a compost system don't exist in the ocean. So it behaves in the same way as a plastic bag. And there's also a lot of energy and land required to make them. So not a great solution. And then other countries have actually shifted to, if you imagine what your tangerines come in, that kind of plastic webbing, shifted to those in supermarkets for plastic bags instead. And so there's, we sort of try and make headway, and then actually other problems are created off the back of it. It's a good start. It gets everybody aware. There's still lots to do.
For people that perhaps haven't grasped exactly what a single-use plastic item is, can you explain what it is?
Single-use plastic. So it's something that we use just once and then throw away. And plastic is a material that actually really lasts forever. And so then when we go and make products like a piece of packaging or a water bottle or a plastic bag or a straw that's designed to be used for 10 minutes or maybe half an hour and then thrown away, it just doesn't really make any sense.
Okay, well, that's rounded up nicely. Now, you've obviously had a very inspiring history, and this last 16 years, you've spent a lot of time, developing your knowledge and experience, and empowering yourself with the knowledge of what's going on in the oceans. There are many people, I'm sure, that would like to perhaps follow your path in some way or the other. But the one thing that always tends to be a conversation starter or stopper, as the case may be, is actually how people could make ends meet while being a environmentalist in some format or other. Is it an easy job to, not an easy job, but is it a realistic job to be an environmentalist and try and put yourself in front of industrialists and make a change?
I think it's becoming increasingly easier to make a career out of it. I think certainly when I started out, it was pretty rare to hear of somebody making a living from it. And it definitely took me many years to get to that point. And I think I started young enough that I was lucky enough that I didn't really need to be making money in those first few years. And I was very much up for an adventure and kind of trading my time and my skills for whatever I needed to survive, which was a great way to get a lot of experience that I would never have got otherwise. But there's a lot more courses now that you can do at university working in the environmental sector that do then lead on to jobs. But I would also say that I think it's not necessarily about studying the environment, but it's about potentially studying something else, you know, whatever it is that you're brilliant at and that you really enjoy. So whether that's law or finance or writing or filmmaking or science, it's working out, you know, what are you really good at? And then where does that intersect the issue? Because when it comes to solving these global problems, we really need every different skill to come and work on it. And so just becoming skilled in whatever your field is and then applying that to the environment, I think is a really good way to make a living and do something that you care about.
Fantastic. Okay, thanks for that. Right, well, one final question, because I know you're a busy lady and you've got people to talk to, and it's a big question, and it's a big subject, and so I shall give you a few moments to think about this. But on the subject matter we've been discussing, of all the things I could have asked you about it, what should I have asked you?
I think you covered off what we should be doing and what others can do. And that's really the main message to get out there. There's so many avenues to go, to be honest.
Well, I said that at the very beginning before I spoke to you.
I know, there's 10 different podcasts we kind of talked about.
We should start our series. We should start the series.
Yeah, exactly. But no, I mean, I think certainly the questions that I always get asked is one of them is kind of how do I get to do this too, and how can I really make a difference. They're really important, but I think you covered those. We talked about government, we talked about industry and individuals. I think you've covered a lot actually in a short period of time.
Well, that's good news. Well, I hope the listeners appreciate that as well. Thank you very much indeed for your time. I realise how busy you are, and I'm so glad you managed to squeeze me in. But I'd love to talk to you at a later stage, perhaps getting towards the end of the X expedition, to see what conclusions, what's happened since.
That sounds great. Yeah, look forward to it.
I tried to get an update today from Emily regarding how the X expedition was getting on, and where they were presumably in isolation. According to the website, the boat should be somewhere near Easter Island, but I'm awaiting confirmation. I hope you found this podcast interesting and thought-provoking. My thanks to Emily for taking the time, and I hope she and all the other associated ladies around the world get the attention and impact they deserve for their hard work. Of course, all the details, links, photographs and more information can be found over on the outdoorstation.co.uk website. Please share this podcast amongst your social circle, and if you can, please let me have some feedback on social media or wherever you've seen this. The next few weeks are going to be really busy for me, so please do get involved. Come along to the live streams and help shape future shows. If nothing else, it'll help you pass an hour. So until next time, folks, take care in your isolation, and bye for now.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To hear or see more from our extensive free library, please visit theoutdoorsstation.co.uk.